The BioInsights Podcast.
This episode is called Navigating Genomics and Transcriptomics in the Immuno-Oncology Space. I'm Lauren Coyle, an editor with BioInsights, and in this episode, we'll be exploring genomics, transcriptomics, and spatial profiling in the immuno-oncology space. Joining me today is Katie Campbell, a postdoctoral fellow at the Cancer Research Institute. Katie is this month's rising star, recommended by her colleague Samik Upataya. She's currently working on analysing next-generation sequencing to better identify predictors of response and resistance to PD-1 immunotherapy. Thank you for joining me today, Katie. Can we start with you telling us a bit about your career in the immuno-oncology space and what you're currently working on?
My graduate studies at WashU started back in 2014, and I was introduced to cancer genomics. And the genomic space quite rapidly became cancer informatics in general. And cancer informatics space, especially with the progress through the approval of various checkpoint inhibitors, became cancer informatics and cancer immune informatics, really. So that was my introduction to this space kind of from 2014 to 2018. And during that time, I was introduced to checkpoint inhibitors and learning about cancer and the immune system by studying a clinical trial focused in treating head and neck cancer with pembrolizumab in the neoadjuvant space. And then when I pursued my postdoc studies, I began studying this at a much larger scale in larger phase two clinical trials with various immuno-oncology agents and parallelizing a lot of the cutting edge technologies in genomics, transcriptomics, and spatial profiling, which brings me to my current status as a junior faculty member at UCLA. Now I kind of integrate all of these technologies to continue understanding how we can best leverage cancer immune interactions for therapeutic approaches. And I do that by studying clinical samples and large data sets.
Yeah, it sounds like some interesting stuff you've done so far. So then just onto the second question, looking to genomics and transcriptomics data, how has this successfully been implemented in IO so far, and what challenges remain to be solved?
This question could go on forever. So starting with genomics and transcriptomics data, since the accomplishment of success of sequencing the human genome, that gave us the reference and the starting point to do everything else, followed by successfully sequencing the first cancer genome a number of years ago. This has led to a lot of data generation as well as technological advancements since. And so genomics and transcriptomics have become one of the more cost-effective way to broadly profile tumors. And so I would say it's been successfully implemented in the establishment of various companion diagnostics. When it comes to genomics, there are known genetic drivers of cancer itself, but also known genetic implications in driving resistance or sensitivity to drugs. And so having this companion information with clinical data allows us to really understand what's working and what's not. Transcriptomics takes it another step further because it's not just the genetic status of things, but also how things are behaving. And so a number of gene panels and predictors of response have been generated, but we've been able to very much leverage transcriptomics data to understand things like some of the signaling events that happen upon the successful recognition and elimination of cancer cells by the immune system. As for challenges, I would say that I think one of the biggest challenges remains how do we successfully implement these into the clinical setting? And given that everybody has their favorite gene panel or technology, I think there needs to be continued efforts of the establishment as well as testing of these predictors or companion diagnostics in real time. And I think that we've been a little bit limited in advancing that companion diagnostic information.
So then how could these challenges like integration then be addressed going forward? I know you kind of touched on that there, but was there any more you wanted to add?
I think it's important to do this prospectively. And so what I've seen at UCLA and what I think is really been done well in some settings is as clinical trials are planned, especially with newer agents and maybe in the earlier phase two setting when you're working with a smaller collection of patients where you can really do this deep dive, I think we need to utilize that information that we learn and propose that as secondary endpoints or additional translational objectives as we continue to plan for new clinical trials. And so the challenge there is that if the diagnostic itself is wrong, maybe it's not necessarily the best way to prospectively enroll patients into that trial. But I think we need to find ways to creatively integrate the technology into the planning for those clinical trials.
So then how does the integration of spatial profiling data contribute to a better understanding of molecular drivers and cellular interactions? And what considerations do you take when integrating these into your research?
So spatial profiling is a little bit more behind in terms of the standardization and the effective implementation and analysis. So when in genomics and transcriptomics, we have many years and many groups that have agreed upon and benchmarked and tested all of these very complicated ways to address these data. When it comes to spatial profiling, there are limitations because a lot of the cutting edge technologies are either expensive or we just don't really know how to best study them yet. Important word being there, yet. But the thing about spatial profiling is that it brings clarity to the information that becomes inferred by the genomics or transcriptomics data. So now, rather than just saying these cells are there and they're expressing this gene, now we can start to say these cells are talking to each other and this is how they're behaving together. So I think the spatial profiling, especially the quick advancement of the plexity of these agents, and I'm talking, you know, in protein land, we started in with single stain IHC, and that started with one or two stains. And then we moved on to six or seven plex with multiplex immunofluorescence. In some high resolution technologies, we're in like the 30 to 40 range, but it's quickly becoming into the hundreds and then thousands of transcripts. And so the resolution of that information, if it's done and if it's done well, can really take what we interpreted from transcriptomic data in particular and really say this is actually what's happening because you've captured a picture of it. So the considerations of integrating this type of technology effectively into research, whether it's experimental, clinical, translational, whichever setting you're considering, and number one is going to be cost, because each of them has a varying degree of cost, often associated with their resolution or plexity. The second consideration is resource. And so sometimes the answer is, what is your collaborator working with, or who do you have that relationship with in order to effectively access that technology? Because not all of the platforms are going to be available everywhere or easily done everywhere. Finally, it really comes down to, I think the most important consideration is, what's the question? Do you need 100 proteins and 20,000 RNA in order to answer your question of interest? I think we're at a really interesting time to take information and this discovery approach that's so emphasized in data informatics and move back into this hypothesis-driven approach in terms of making these decisions and saying, what is the scientific question of interest? If you're interested in how tumor cells are behaving, a lot of the protein panels are going to be heavily focused in the immune space. And so if your questions are about what tumor cells are doing, don't waste your time, money, and resources on a low-plexity panel that's only going to tell you where the immune cells are, because it's not going to effectively address the question at hand. And so I think this is one of the major mistakes that I see. Just because we have these shiny new toys doesn't mean we need to play with them all the time. And so I think that these are these are the interesting types of considerations and decisions that need to be made as we effectively progress the science and not just the technology.
When it comes to figuring out the best way to navigate the question, do you think it's better to start with a clear hypothesis and stick to it, or have you seen people take different routes that work well?
This is where I really think about how I would incorporate this type of technology into a grant. If you were to write a specific aim in a grant and say, I'm going to generate 100 terabytes of data on the spatial transcriptome of these samples, that's great. And one of the common criticisms is that, okay, you're going on a fishing expedition. So I think we have to focus on the why are we generating that data? Well, if the clinical context is something that is going to advance treatment, we want to understand the context of that treatment. And so the focus has to be that question of why was that context created? Okay, so you take another step back and you say, okay, we want to overcome PD-1 resistance. Well, we hypothesize that this drug is going to overcome PD-1 resistance in this way. And so now that you have that hypothesis, you can say, okay, well, if that's how I think it's working clinically, then I need the data to address that question. And so what I like to think about is, can the technology address that hypothesis? And let's say the hypothesis is wrong. Can it also allow me to analyze all of the alternative considerations or interpretations or mechanisms that may be responsible? And so this builds upon having a reason for getting those samples and using that technology and saying, okay, if the answer to my hypothesis is no, can I address the next four questions? And I think that that's a really interesting way to consider how we can best utilize these technologies in high-dimensional data sets.
In your current research on somatic alterations and antigen-presenting machinery, how do you approach analysis of HLA genes?
So the HLAs, HLA encodes human leukocyte antigens, which are an element of the antigen presentation machinery on all of our cells. And it's the way that our immune system sees our cells as normal or diseased. Disease being, it could be an infectious disease like a virus, or it could be cancer in terms of those antigens being different. But those HLA genes are very different, both within us and across us as individuals, which is great from an evolutionary standpoint in terms of our immune systems diversifying in order to eradicate diseases within our bodies, which can ultimately prevent us from spreading diseases to other people. But also the challenge there is that it makes them really hard to study. The polymorphic nature means that there's thousands and thousands and thousands of different HLA alleles or versions of these genes that make it hard to study with just one single human reference. So we have to think about them at the individual level. And this is really better done with genomic and transcriptomic technologies because those sequencing reads can really differentiate the different alleles. And we can use the information that we know to map them back to the HLA genes and then more comprehensively and more specifically characterize a patient's immune system in the context of their cancer. So one of the ways that we do that is leveraging a lot of the work that's been done in the genomic space to account for variability across the HLA gene locus. And then if we can tell the difference between two things, we can also sort them and study them independently. And so that's really the approach that we take to look at the HLA alleles and study it in the context of an individual's cancer.
Could you discuss any strategies you've employed to identify and characterize copy number alterations in the antigen-presenting machinery?
So we study this at the genomic level using whole exome sequencing data in particular. And that allows us to perform HLA haplotyping and actually count the number of reads associated with each allele. We can also study it at the transcriptome level, similarly where we separate the reads based upon the polymorphisms and we can assign them to each allele and then compare them and quantify them. And then finally, at the protein level, using various, we can consider it with patient tissues, we can consider it with cell line data, but we can stain those samples with allele-specific antibodies. And so basically it comes down to how can you tell the difference between two HLA alleles in order to say one is from the maternal allele versus the paternal allele. And then we can either sort them at the sequencing level or we can stain for them differentially at the protein level.
Thank you. And how do you collaborate with experts from different fields such as immunology, genomics and computational biology? And how has this contributed to the progress of your research?
Science is not meant to be done in a silo. And it's what I don't envy in for trainees at this stage is how much you have to know in order to progress your research. That is such a challenge to be having to learn everything in real time and then also apply it and succeed. And so, again, I don't envy trainees. In fact, I'm constantly trying to think about what they need to know versus what they should know versus what they should learn. And then the important question there is, who can you work with in order to make sure that it's being addressed from all angles? So that being said, none of my work is done alone. My background was predominantly in, going back to undergrad, I was dissecting fruit flies for my undergraduate research. And so my background or basis was in biochemistry. And then I was in the molecular cell biology program for my PhD, but working in a genomics lab and studying clinical trial samples, I was collaborating with clinicians. And then because one of the clinical trials happened to be an immunotherapy trial, I started attending lab meetings of cancer immunology lab. So it really, in terms of how this has contributed to my progress, I wouldn't be here without it. I really love the team science attitude because that productive discourse and dialogue or disagreement and interpretation relies on the expertise of the technology, the science, the biology, the medicine, and really integrating these varying perspectives in order to say, are we right? Because if you don't have those considerations, if you don't have those perspectives in that project, then there's a good chance you could be missing something. And so I would say I don't just collaborate with these individuals, but I consider my entire training a product of that mentorship across those disciplines. And so I hope that especially individuals in bioinformatics and biological data science really consider that your coding might not mean anything without the integration of the knowledge of the biology. You really want to focus on questions that mean something and matter and aren't just statistically sound.
What are your main goals and aspirations for the future?
So I can tell you when I decided I wanted to be a scientist. And so that always was the goal. And I was literally eight. I was sitting in my third grade classroom and I learned about, or fourth grade, excuse me, and I learned about microorganisms for the first time. And I went home and I told my dad I was going to be a scientist. So I had no idea what that entailed or what that career trajectory would look or feel like. But the courses that I took and the trajectory that I pursued was basically continuing this quest of, I want to be a scientist. It wasn't really, I would say, until graduate school that I had incredible mentorship and leadership and guidance to say that I didn't want to just be a scientist. I wanted to do good science. And so that has been the aspiration and always is the aspiration. And I'm fortunate to say that with the training that I've had in the academic setting, that has been very supportive of that aspiration. And so the goal is to continue to do good science and progress through this faculty transition. I've only been a junior faculty member for a couple months now, so it's still fresh, but continue pursuing that trajectory as long as I'm doing good science. And that's not to say that there isn't plenty of good science out there. The one thing we didn't talk about in terms of collaboration is industry and the nonprofit sector and the government sector. There's just incredible science, incredible progress being made in all of these settings. And so as long as I get to continue being a part of that forward progress, then I will feel like that goal is continuing to be achieved.
Thank you again for a fantastic discussion, Katie, and thank you to our audience for listening. If you enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to subscribe to the BioInsights podcast.